do this.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to Books and Beer. I am your host, Michael Malone. You may have noticed that we haven't done the show in some time. It was a radio show out of WVOX on your AM dial and a podcast too. Now it is podcast only, but still focusing on local New York authors and great craft beer. I'm happy to be podcasting out of the Oath Craft Beer Sanctuary on the main drag in Tarrytown. The beer selection, well, you just have to see it for yourself. 20 taps. Kent Falls Saison, Single Cut Mo Shuggy, Weird Beard Little Things That Kill, batch number 9. I don't even know what that means. The Oath is a little slice of hoppy heaven here along the Hudson. We will sample a few of the Oath's more unique offerings today, which the owner, Joe, is bringing out for us as we speak. Thank you very much. And my guest today is the author, Linda Cohen-Leugman. Said it right?
Yep, you said it right.
All week I meant
first
to
try.
Ask you about the pronunciation of your last name, but I took a stab and I didn't.
Good job, Mike.
Okay, so she's the author of the debut novel, The Two Family House. Here's what the author, Cassandra King, said about Linda's book. In this spellbinding family saga, two women share a terrible secret that binds them for life, yet has the power to destroy everything they love most. With masterful control, Linda Cohen-Leugman boldly explores the anguish and joys of families united by blood and shared loyalties, even as they are divided by jealousy, passion, and mistrust. The Two Family House is that rare old-fashioned read you never want to end. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, happy to have you. It's you're part of history, it being the first show strictly.
I'm very excited.
Out of the Oath. What do you think of the bar?
It's a great place. It has this great, the listeners can't see it, but it has this huge oak door,
yep.
Which is kind of very gothic, and these wood tables and the tile floor, it has like a really cool old-timey feel.
Yep.
So I like it.
Yep. It's only been open a year, but it does have that sort of lived-in feel,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
So tell me how the book came to be.
So the setting for the book actually was inspired by stories that my mom and her two sisters, my aunts, used to tell me when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
They grew up in a two-family house in Brooklyn, and my mom was born in the 40s. And my grandmother and, you know, had three daughters living upstairs, and her brother lived downstairs with his three daughters.
Okay.
So they were raised in that house kind of all together, cousins, but sort of sibling-ish. And my grandmother used to tell stories about how, you know, the girls from downstairs would come up with two slices of bread and say, "Aunt Tilly, give us something to put in the middle," because she was the cook in the family. And she got along really well with her sister-in-law downstairs. They were very close, and they were opposites. Her sister-in-law was one of those like women who was ahead of her time, and she was the first one to learn to drive, and she didn't like to cook, and my grandmother was like the traditionalist. So opposites got along very well,
yeah.
And they were very good friends. So those were stories that I grew up on, and I kind of always knew if I would ever write a book, it would be about that time period, it would be in that place, because it just had such a magical kind of quality for me. I grew up in Western Massachusetts, which was not magical at all.
Right.
I grew up near Springfield in Longmeadow. And I just had one brother. And so, you know, it was kind of boring. So this whole like house with these six girls running around just seemed very lively and exciting to me. And then when I was pregnant with my daughter, my first child, I thought a lot about, you know, what kind of baby I was going to have. I really wanted to have a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know why I wanted to have a girl so much. And I kind of had this deal with my husband that if we had two boys, we would go for a third and try for a girl.
Right.
And I used to think about that. And when my daughter was about 6 months old, there was an article in the New York Times magazine called Getting the Girl, which was about like gender, the very beginnings. It was 17 years ago now. So it was about the very beginnings of that kind of gender pre-selection, which is all over the news now.
Yep.
With different celebrities like pre-selecting gender. And I thought about, you know, how far people would go. Like I had the girl that I wanted, but what would I have been like these people? Would I have spent like thousands of dollars that I did not have special, you know, IVF or whatever kinds of things? And it just made me think and kind of reimagine that house from the childhood stories that I was told. with a different setup, with, you know, like in that house, there was no jealousy, there was no, you know, tension. What if there was? What if upstairs there was a family with four boys? And what if downstairs there was a family with three girls? And what if the parents in those families wanted what they didn't have?
Right.
What would happen then? How would it play out? What would it look like? And that's kind of where it started.
Okay, so I'm not going to ask you to give away too much, but the story... The pivotal moment in the book, it is a snowy night in, what, December?
Mm-hmm. In December.
And these two sisters-in-law.
It's 1947. It's 1947 in Brooklyn. There actually was, like, a historic blizzard in 1947 in New York City, and it was, like, I don't know, 3 feet of snow was dumped on the city of New York, and everything shut down. And that kind of, you know, when I was started to do research into this time period and what I wanted to think about, that kind of became the perfect... just the perfect backdrop for that scene. So the women, you know, they're sisters-in-law, they're very close, their husbands are brothers. They end up getting pregnant kind of a little bit later in life. They didn't think they were going to, but it ends up happening that way. And of course, each one wants what they don't have.
Right.
And when the husbands are away, they're in business, they have a company together, they're in Philadelphia. And one woman goes into labor and, you know, the stress and everything the other woman does too. And the only person who can come to be with them is a midwife. They can't get to the hospital. There's a lot of hysteria. There's a lot of, you know, frantic calls, but there's no possibility of getting to a hospital. So a midwife comes to deliver. Mm-hmm. And the idea for that chapter was to really kind of make it very sort of blurry, very kind of mystical. The woman, the midwife, kind of floats in on the snow. You know, she doesn't have a name. The only time you really see her is in the prologue of the book, which was, you know, the whole idea of that chapter is to just kind of cast doubt in the reader's mind as to what really happened that night.
Yeah.
Because when that night is over, Helen, who's the mother of boys, has a girl, and Rose, who's the mother of three girls, has a boy.
Yeah.
And they get what they want. But how did that happen?
Yeah. So. Yeah, that sort of parable quality to it. It reminded me a little bit of almost like a Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We don't want to give too much away, but a very compelling little twist to the story set in that scene. Tell me about the route to publication, how you found an agent.
Okay,
you were a lawyer, or you are. I guess one is a lawyer.
I'm a recovering lawyer. That's
recovering
what we call
lawyer.
It, yeah.
Okay, so a law career.
A law career, yeah. I was a lawyer, yes. So I was a lawyer. I was actually a trust and estates lawyer, which is those lawyers that, you know, write wills for people and handle estates. And I worked first at a big New York firm. And that was kind of the only law I wanted to practice. And the reason for that was really... my very first assignment, I sat in this guy's office. He was this very distinguished, very kind gentleman, and he told me a story about his client, which had to do with, like, a mistress and a wife in a mental institution illegitimate children. And it was this wild, crazy story, and the legal stuff to research was, like, laws of inheritance for illegitimate children in different states, but that was kind of beside the point. Like, the whole thing was that this was this really awesome story, and that's what I was fixated on. I probably should have known then that I shouldn't be a lawyer, that I didn't care about the legal stuff, I just cared about the story. But that was kind of a good sort of lawyer for me to be for a while. So I did that for 8 years in a couple of big New York City firms. I had kids, I worked as a legal recruiter for a while, I did some part-time stuff, and then about 6 years ago, I started taking classes at Sarah Lawrence. They have a great writing institute there in Bronxville.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had this story in my head, the story was something I knew that I wanted to write. By that point, I had, like, been talking about it for so long. It was, my husband was sick of listening to me.
He's like,
just put it down on paper, please stop talking to me about it. So I started taking that class. I worked on it for about 5 years. The second book is coming up more quickly.
Yeah.
The first book took a long time. I didn't really know what I was doing. And when I was done, I was pretty much done. I went to a conference, which actually was a conference at Sarah Lawrence on publishing and promoting your book.
Okay.
And I met my agent. I had a lot of luck on my side. It was very, very fortuitous. And I met this really wonderful agent. Her name's Marley Rusoff. And I met her at that conference. She had read a couple pages of my book and she really liked it. And I guess she felt like it was a story that she hadn't heard before. Mm. You know, there are so many variations on so many stories.
Right.
And I'm sure that there is a variation on the one that I'm telling in this book too, but she felt like it was something that she hadn't heard. And she asked me to send it to her.
Well, that's kind of a catch-22 in that a lot of agents or editors want that law of precedence. They want to say, well, this was a hit, so we want something in that vein.
It's interesting, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because when one of the things that I found out, when you go to pitch a book to an agent or an editor, one of the things they really want to know is, what are the comparables for this book?
Right.
What is this book like? Because their first thought really is, how do I sell this book? So there's this interplay between, you know, the creative side and the business side. And that's something that you have to really wrap your head around right away. And you can't be shy about it. So, you know, when I went in, I had thought of that, because friends of mine who were further along in the process had told me that. So, you know, there's a book called The Memory Keeper's Daughter by Kim Edwards, which is a book that I didn't read until I was done with my book, but I had read it before I met with this agent. And it's another book about a family secret involving a child.
Okay.
And it kind of caught my eye first because it starts out with a snowstorm. Like, that's a baby born in a snowstorm also. So it was interesting. And there were a couple other, you know, books that I was thinking about and telling them about. So, you know, they kind of want both. They want something that people can latch onto and something that they feel like they know how to sell, but then they want something fresh at the same time.
Right.
So you have to kind of be able to do both.
Okay.
So
how long was the process once you signed on with Marlee Rusoff before she was able to secure you a deal?
Right. So I sent her my manuscript in July, at the very end of July. And she called me just a few days later, which was great. My husband actually thought I had, like, fallen in the kitchen and bumped my head because I called him at work, and he thought I was, like, hallucinating. And I said, this agent wants to represent me. So he was really thrilled. But so from that moment on, we tweaked the book a little bit. Not very much, but there was a little bit of tweaking. And Marlee has been in the business of publishing for a very long time. She used to own a bookstore. She started, like, a literary center in Minneapolis, where she's from. Which is now this huge not-for-profit literary center called The Loft. And then she was in publishing for a while, and then she became an agent. So she kind of knows all sides, and she knows a lot of people. And the benefit, I mean, the luck and the benefit of having somebody like that is that she sends people things and they read it. You know, they read it, then they get back to her, which is a blessing. So, you know, she sent it, and there were comments early on, and interest, and it was great. But of course, you know, I was so nervous about the whole thing, and every time I was waiting to hear from someone, it was like a little bit of torment, you know, just waiting, those weeks of waiting. And, so we tweaked a little bit based on a few early comments from some people that she really trusted that she wanted to read. And then there were rejections, you know, like there were editors that didn't want it for whatever reason.
Not
and,
for us.
Yeah, exactly.
Loved
and
it,
so, right. You know, quiet. Quiet is one of those words that some of my writer friends and I hate because, you know, everyone seems to want a book that's very, very loud. And we don't really know what that means. I think that means like a thriller kind of, maybe.
So they
would
describe it as quiet.
As quiet.
Oh, that's interesting.
Quiet. So, so sometimes a book can be too quiet.
Okay.
And so we've sort of decided we're going to write in all capital letters. So then everything will be very loud.
Turn up the volume.
So there were, you know, I don't know. I think there were 10 rejections. And the 11th... The 11th was the charm. So, and that was Jennifer Weiss from St. Martin's Press.
Okay.
And she really liked the book. So that was in November. So it was, you know, August when Marlee started sending it out. So it was kind of end of August, September, October, November.
Okay.
And so it really, like, I cannot complain.
You cannot complain.
I cannot complain because it was a really, as slow as the publishing process is, that was really quick.
Yeah.
It didn't feel quick to me at the time,
no,
but it really feels quick to me now.
So in terms of, while you're writing this, you're kind of dreaming about this day when an agent who, while you're writing this, you don't know exists, but this agent calls and says you've got a book deal, and you imagine what it feels like. So when that day finally arrived in November, did it feel the way you expected? Was it better? Was it not quite as amazing? What was the feeling?
It was really amazing, I have to say, because, well, I'm 47 years old, so, you know, I mean, I think I'm a kind of a young 47, but whatever, I'm 47 years old, and it's... There were a lot of times in my life where I really wasn't happy with what I was doing.
Yeah.
So being a lawyer, I worked with a lot of nice people. you know, there were a lot of nice things about it. But I didn't love what I was doing. I didn't love the actual work. Right. And this is work that I really love. So when someone says to you, hey, you know, like, we're validating your work. We're saying we want to buy this book and you're going to get your... It was kind of like a dream come true moment. It really was.
Sure.
And it was when Marley, when I first talked to Marley and she said she wanted to represent me too. Because, of course, like, everything is a step in that process, right? So at first, you only dream of getting an agent. Like, that's the first dream.
Right.
So when that dream happened, that was like, you know, crazy, crazy amazing, right? And then when someone actually said they wanted to publish it, even more crazy amazing.
What were you doing when you...
I was in my kitchen. Both times, which is sad. I don't know what that says about me. I was just in my kitchen at home. Yeah, actually, when Marley first called me, I had emailed her the book, and she had emailed me back, which was very kind of her, because, you know, a lot of people won't acknowledge receipt of what you've sent them, so then people will sit around wondering, well, maybe they didn't get it, and maybe my email didn't work. So she had acknowledged it right away. And said she was really swamped, but she was going to get to it as soon as she could. So, of course, I was prepared to wait for a long time. And I'm kind of like a little... I was over-enthusiastic, as I tend to be. And I wrote back. You know, she said I got it, and I wrote back, thanks so much. I'm so looking forward to hearing from you. And then I thought, as soon as I sent it, I was like, ugh, I think I went one email too far.
Yeah.
And then when she called, her name popped up in my, you know, and it was only 2 days later, so her name popped up on my caller ID, and I honestly thought it was like her assistant saying, hey, back off, lady. Like, stop being a stalker. Don't email anymore. And then it was her. So that was kind of, I don't know, it was a crazy moment. It was kind of like, I don't know, it was kind of outer body-ish, you know.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, this seems like a really good moment to celebrate with a drink.
Okay.
Here. Do you want to
try?
We've got a cider and we've got a beer.
Okay.
What do you want to try?
I'll try the beer, because the beer is kind of neat.
Let's do the beer.
Okay. And it looks... People can't see it, but it looks
tell
kind
us
of...
about their color.
Okay, so it's beautiful. It looks kind of like lemonade, like a thick lemonade, or I don't know, like it looks like...
What color would you call it?
I don't want to say amber, because I think the cider is more amber. I mean, it's almost gold.
Yeah.
It's really like a golden kind of a color.
Okay.
It's like a lemon meringue pie color.
Sort of.
I don't know. It's beautiful.
We've got the Newburgh Rodeo Clown.
Okay.
And we got a little background noise because we are in a working pub here. Let me tell you about this beer. A dry hopped grisette or a Belgian wheat saison. Light in body and refreshing in flavor. With Rodeo Clown, we generously dry hop the beer, which provides for a floral aroma, followed by notes of fresh lemongrass and herbs. So give it a smell. You can use a cheat sheet here. You can always say, hey, it smells sort of like fresh lemongrass and herbs.
But it looks lemony, and it does smell lemony.
Yeah, no, you nailed the lemon part of it.
Yeah, and it definitely... It's really good. I mean, because I'm not a huge beer drinker.
No,
like, full disclosure.
Not a beer drinker. No, full disclosure.
Full disclosure. I wanted you to change the title of the show to Words and Wine, but or I don't know, Stories and Chocolate. I don't know what goes with chocolate.
Okay.
Yes.
No,
but
you don't have to.
But it's really No, but it's really good, and it is very fruity, and it has a lot of nice. It just has a lot of nice flavors to it.
Yeah.
It has like a wine type of a, I don't know, something to it.
Something that also I would think well suited for this time of year, although the wind is whipping out there, but we are starting to move into spring. And personally, I drink an awful lot of the big hoppy sort of cold weather type beers that just have a lot of pop to them. And this is a real nice alternative to that, something a little lighter. And the alcohol on this is 5.1%, which is really not that much in this day and age. That's probably comparable to a Bud or something like that, whereas some of these hoppy beers might be 7, 8, 9%. So you could have one of these at lunch and go back to work conceivably and not feel like taking a nap.
Yeah, it's pretty light.
Okay, so
you know,
again,
it's not a heavy it's not a heavy kind of a taste. And it's pretty. I like that it's pretty.
Yeah, it is a very unique color for a beer, one you don't see very often.
No, you don't.
Okay.
I like it.
Good.
It looks nice with the book, too.
It actually kind of matches the book.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a beer to go with your copy of The Two Family House, we suggest the Newburgh Rodeo Clown. And another aspect of, as the name suggests, Newburgh Rodeo Clown, it is a New York beer. Newburgh just being up, I don't know, up the Taconic, up up north.
Well, there's the something Newburgh Bridge, too.
Yes.
Right? So yes. It's got to be near that.
You're right. Absolutely right. So part of the Empire State here, we do try to support the local breweries as much as possible. Let us continue here. Do you think you want to read from your book a little bit here?
Sure. You know, I could read... I could do one of two things. You can tell me. I could read the chapters in this book. So the book, just to let people know, it alternates between points of view of four adults, the two couples, the men, Mort and Abe, and the women, Helen and Rose, and then two of the children.
Yep.
So the chapters are fairly short because we get, you know, everybody's kind of two cents and we do a full circle around to see some scenes from different perspectives. Or I could read the prologue. Either way. So I'm going to let you choose. You get to pick.
Okay. Which character has the other?
Rose.
Rose. Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't you read the Rose chapter?
Okay.
Give us a little background.
Okay. So Rose is the mother of three girls. She, when the book starts, she probably undergoes one of the biggest transformations of characters in the book. And when the book starts, she's a pretty meek and kind of put upon character, and her husband is very difficult. Mm-hmm. He's very controlling, and he has been, although she loved him when they got married, every time they had a girl, he was a little less kind to her. He was a little bit more cold. Blamed her for not really being able to give him the son, because, you know, this is 1947. He wants a son. He wants an heir. His older brother has four sons. Mm-hmm. There's a family business. He's jealous. And now she finds herself pregnant, and she is very surprised because he is remarkably excited about the pregnancy. She thought she wouldn't get pregnant again. She was dreading even telling him about it. And he has sort of assumed that they're just going to have a son.
Yep.
So although she's enjoying a little bit of a respite from his controlling and really negative ways because he's trying to be more positive, it's weighing on her because she's so worried about what happens if I have another girl.
Right.
You know, if I have another girl, that's like the nail in the coffin.
Yep.
That's kind of what she's thinking. So at this point, he is away for his first visit to Philadelphia with his brother. They've gotten like a new account for their box, their cardboard box business.
Okay.
So this is Rose. From the minute Rose got out of bed that morning, she felt changed, lighter somehow. Mort had gotten up early to go to Philadelphia with Abe, and the whole day lay ahead of her, unencumbered. Once the children were off to school, she wasn't sure what to do with herself. Mort was always gone by this time of the morning, so the day shouldn't have felt different from any other, but it did. The first thing she realized was that she didn't have to make pot roast for dinner. It was Wednesday, and Wednesday night was pot roast night, at least according to Mort. If something else was served, or if she made pot roast on a Saturday instead, Mort would be visibly disappointed. His absence freed her of this restriction. It came to her then, pot roast and enlightenment entwined, the reason why Mort's absence affected her so. She hadn't known what it was until it wasn't there. The daily dread of being judged, of being measured and found lacking in some small way, was a burden she carried, compact and profound. It was a too heavy purse, worn and comfortable on her shoulder, which she did not know the weight of until she set it down. Ever since Judith was born, Rose realized, Mort had been struggling to maintain control. He could not manipulate the outcome of her pregnancies, and he could not change their daughters into sons. Faced with these setbacks, he was determined to control whatever else was left. What their girls were allowed to read, what they wore, where they went, how much affection he would show to his wife, and though it seemed trivial, even what Rose made for dinner. Rose opened up the cabinet next to the sink and took out her mother's recipe box. The box was yellow painted tin with black and red flowers etched onto the sides. The top was copper, faded with brown spots and stains. Some of the recipes were typed onto cards and some were handwritten on scraps of paper. Others were just torn pieces of magazine pages, folded haphazardly and stuffed inside. None of the recipes was in any particular order, and every time Rose looked through them, she had to spend at least 10 minutes searching for the one that she wanted. That was the fun of it, though. The recipe box was the only part of her mother that Rose had left. When her mother died, Rose didn't care about the jewelry. All Rose really wanted was the box. Their mother rarely wore her earrings or necklaces, but Rose knew she had opened the recipe box almost every day. To Rose, it was her mother's touchstone, and she was certain it had absorbed a small part of her mother's essence. Sometimes Rose talked to the box as if her mother were inside it, like a genie in a bottle. She thumbed through the recipes looking for something to make for the girls that night. Salmon croquettes? Too messy. Chicken marbella? Too complicated. She remembered there were lamb chops in the freezer, but she just couldn't bring herself to defrost them. She was halfway through the box when her fingertips came upon a white recipe card with frayed edges. The blue printing across the top read, "From the kitchen of Sylvia Pelt." It was a recipe for cheese blintzes, and Rose's mouth started watering as soon as she saw it. Sylvia had been her mother's good friend. She couldn't remember the last time she had made blintzes. They were time-consuming and complicated. Plus, Mort didn't like them. And even if he did, he certainly wouldn't approve of having them for dinner. Rose remembered one night years ago when all the girls were recovering from the flu and she had made them scrambled eggs and toast for dinner. "What's this?" Mort had grumbled as soon as he sat down. "Eggs. The girls don't feel well and the doctor said to give them something plain when they feel ready to eat again. Eggs and toast is the right thing for them to eat." "Hmm. I'm sorry, Mort. I'll make chicken and dumplings tomorrow. It just seemed like a waste to make it today." "No, tomorrow is pot roast night." That was how she knew he expected certain dishes on certain days, and that breakfast food wasn't to be served for dinner. Oh, there were variations for sure, but they usually weren't successful. He would give her a look, close a door too hard, or do something else to let her know that he wasn't pleased. She had to admit that Mort had been kinder lately, more attentive, caring. He was no longer indifferent to her, but it wasn't enough. Mort's efforts were because of the new baby, her biggest test yet. If she failed, she knew what it would do to him this time, and what that, in turn, would do to her. It wouldn't be like making eggs for dinner or having pot roast on the wrong night of the week. He would never forgive her. "This has to work out," she said to the recipe box. Rose tried to imagine her mother in miniature, dressed like a genie in harem pants and scarves, but all she could come up with was a vision of her in a housecoat and apron. Whatever her mother was wearing, Rose hoped she was listening. She rubbed the tin box a few times, for luck.
Nice job.
Thanks. Well.
Boy, he is such a drip. He does
he
warm
is.
Up as the book goes on.
Yeah, he does.
Whatever.
He does.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So there's a real art to reading, and you're a good reader. Do you have any readings, any public sessions coming up?
Yeah, I have a couple coming up. So I have something at Sarah Lawrence, actually. They're featuring three new writers, and that's on April 13th at Sarah Lawrence, I think at 6:30. And then in May, I have a couple events with another writer. Her name is Jennifer Brown, and she has a book coming out next week, actually, a week from today, called Modern Girls, which is another New York story set in the Lower East Side, actually. And it's a mother-daughter kind of story. It's got a lot of really interesting themes that, you know, we both share in our books about pregnancy, and hers deals with unwanted pregnancy and just parenting, mothering secrets. So we're speaking together at the Eldridge Street Museum.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, downtown in the city, and that's May 10th. And then on May 11th, we're going to Boston. We're going to be speaking at the Brookline Booksmith, which is a great bookstore in Brookline outside of Boston.
Okay.
And then what else do I have coming up? Oh, I have a UJA event. I'm speaking at that. And a couple other things.
What's UJA?
The UJA is the United Jewish Appeal.
Okay.
So they're doing a Westchester event, like a daytime event, a daytime reading. And I'll just be talking about the book then, which will be great.
Sure.
And let's see. I have a couple. There are a couple really neat online things. So there's an online book club that this really wonderful woman named Robin Homanoff, who has something called Reading with Robin on Facebook, if people want to check it out. So she has a great book club, and she does book groups. So we're doing kind of an online book club, which is neat because I get to be in my sweatpants when I do it at home. And I don't, which is excellent. Because you made me get dressed to come to the bar today, Mike.
Sweatpants would have been perfectly fine.
No, I couldn't do it. Not in public. So that I can do from the privacy of my own home. And that's a really nice thing because readers get to just type in their questions and you just sit there and answer all of them. And
like
she,
fun.
And she kind of curates the whole thing. So she's terrific. And in the fall, I'll be doing another one. There's another, like, there are a couple really wonderful kind of book advocates on Facebook. I'm sure there are more than I have found, but there's another woman named Andrea Katz, and she has something called Great Thoughts, Great Readers. So both of those things I would encourage. Like, if you're a big reader, I would definitely encourage you to go onto those.
Yeah.
You can join, you know, they'll let you, anybody join, readers, writers. So I'm going to be doing a book club with her, a similar kind of thing in the fall. And over the summer, there'll be a bunch of things, but we're just setting them up.
Okay.
So,
this sort of book advocate, this blogger community, they are influential, some of them, that can actually...
They are. You know, for the most part, I think that there are a lot of very kind and very generous people out there who really want to help new authors. And, you know, second and third and fourth time authors also.
Right.
But it's, you know, the whole literary world is just changing. And I actually just went to something last week in the city about Twitter and the literary world. And there's a young woman named Rachel Verschleisser, if I get her name right. She's like in her 30s. She works as head of outreach for Tumblr for literary stuff. And she talks about this a lot, about how, you know, now, like, if you have a favorite author, you can tweet that author and you can say, like, I loved your book. And they might very well, and hopefully they will, like, tweet you back. Like, people, I'm not a famous author by any stretch, but people have tweeted me. And people have emailed me, and that's so, it's so nice for an author.
Sure.
And I think it's so nice for readers too. So, I mean, there are a lot of, writers aren't just like kind of hidden away anymore the way they used to be, you know, years ago when maybe you could get an address and write a letter to your favorite author, but now, like, you can actually say, like, what are you doing next? Like, where are you going to be? What's happening?
Right.
And there's kind of, a lot more accessibility, which is a really nice thing.
What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, that's a good question. It's Linda C. Leuchman, at Linda C. Leuchman.
And it's
L-Y-N-D-A-C...
Okay. Once you spell the whole thing. Yeah.
L-Y-N-D-A-C-L-O-I-G, like good, M-A-N.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you referenced writing letters to authors back in the day, did you do that? Any that you can remember, like Judy Blume or
I didn't write them, no. I mean, I loved them. I loved them. It never occurred to me to write them.
Judy Blume, no,
well, because I was a little girl, you know, back then. Yeah, no, Judy Blume was a big one. Yeah, I loved Judy Blume. I definitely do idolize a lot of authors. And I think if you're a big reader, like, authors are like rock stars to you.
Sure.
You know, like, if you meet one that you've admired, whose books you love, it's crazy. You know, it is like a rock star, because the rock star, you know, someone who's a musician can write a song that just affects you.
Yep.
And you can say it's like a song that changed my life, or it's a song that I heard when I first kissed my husband, or whatever it is, you know, a song from your middle school dance, you know, your first crush, whatever. And books are really that have that same emotional connection, I think. So I think a lot of people, if they're readers, feel that way about authors.
So who are your rock stars then?
My rock stars. I've got a lot of rock stars. Well, Edith Wharton, though she is long past, but she's one of my big, she's just amazing. And I just love, I think I've read everything she's ever written many, many times. She has just inspired me in a lot of ways, though I could never hope to write the way that she does, but she just focuses on that inner thoughts, the inner, like, inner feelings, just that whole inner life of her characters, and that's what I love, that's what I crave.
Quiet
books, exactly. She has some good loud things too, but and more contemporary, I love Alice Hoffman and Anita Diamant, who are both, you know, great women's writers. There are a couple authors that are newer to me now, because now I'm kind of I've been reading a lot more than I ever did, because I'm on these Facebook groups and everyone keeps suggesting these amazing books,
right.
So I keep reading more and more and more, which leaves less time for writing. But so Gillian Cantor and Pam Jonoff are some great historical fiction writers that I really like.
Okay.
So yeah.
So how'd you end up in Chappaqua?
We ended up in Chappaqua because we knew we'd go to Westchester. My husband's from New Jersey, and like I said, I'm from Western Mass. And we used to drive, when my parents still lived in Western Mass, we would drive from New York City to Western Mass and go through all the Westchester towns. And the ones that were closer were too expensive. would go further, and we would say, here's this one, and here's this one. And then we would get further out, and my husband would say, and here's Chappaqua. So there it was, and a couple people from my office that I worked in at the time, who were some really nice guys, lived in Chappaqua. And I don't know, it just, my husband is not one of those, like, he doesn't like to sit on his hands. He makes things happen very quickly. Mm-hmm. And we saw a house and he was like, we just got to get a house. Let's just do it. So I'm much more slow. I'm a slower mover, but yeah. He lights a fire. So I don't know. Before I knew it, there I was.
How many years in Chappaqua?
16 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
You get annoyed when people in the city refer to it as upstate?
No, it doesn't bother me. Okay. Yeah, no, that's okay.
Drives me crazy.
Yeah, that's okay.
So any Clinton stories?
Yeah, so I do have a Clinton story. I have a funny Clinton story, which is my brother-in-law was completely obsessed with Bill Clinton. Loved him, like worshipped him. Bill Clinton was totally his rock star.
Yeah.
And he, the day after Bush's inauguration, when Clinton was going to be, you know, Citizen Clinton for the very first day, he called us the night before and said, I'm coming to Chappaqua tomorrow. He lived in the city. I'm coming to Chappaqua tomorrow. We're going to look for Bill. And our kids were little at the time. And my husband said, what are you talking about? What do you mean? And he said, you know that he's not going to be able to just, like, sit around and not make an appearance. It's his first day, not being president. He's going to be out. We're going to find him. So he was taking an early train, and my husband went to there used to be a grocery store across from Lang's Deli mm-hmm. in Chappaqua back then. And my husband went to pick up a couple of things at the grocery store on the way to the train station, and there was a big hullabaloo across the street in front of Lang's, because Bill Clinton likes Lang's. He was in front of Lang's. There were reporters there. There was a big crowd gathering, and my husband went over and ended up shaking Bill Clinton's hand. He was like, the back of my husband's head was on the news. And then he went to get my brother-in-law from the train and told him what happened. And by the time they got back, Bill Clinton was gone. So they spent the rest of the day driving around searching for Bill Clinton. Geez. And it was so sad. It was like one of those, like, really, I mean, my poor brother-in-law really felt, he was really bummed out. He was so close.
Yeah.
And yet so far.
Oh, boy.
So. But yeah, they're around. They you know, you see them. They always march in the Memorial Day Parade, which is really nice. Yeah. And I think last fall, I wasn't there, but I heard he just sort of like had an impromptu appearance at the Chappaqua Farmers Market and judged the apple pie contest, which must have been pretty exciting. But yeah. I wasn't there to witness that.
Kind of a weird dichotomy. I would think that a lot of Chappaqua probably votes Republican, but then you've got Hillary in the race. So
a lot of people really love Hillary. I think. A lot there's a lot of support for Hillary.
Okay.
So, which is nice.
Well, you're jumping the gun on your side.
Oh, I'm sorry, but it looks really good. Okay.
I know.
I figured I could take a sip and you wouldn't tell everyone. Now you're like spilling
busted.
The beans.
All right. Okay. Let me give us the quick preamble here. Okay, it's a Maalock. Hope I'm saying that correctly. Maalock, M-A-E-L-O-C. Maalock Hard Dry Cider. Brewed using the original process for ancient Celtic ciders. People who have yet to discover dry cider will encounter a light, flavorsome drink, which is original and perfect for a variety of occasions on your way through life. Now, it's a 4.5% alcohol drink. So, again, it's like that beer. Certainly a well-suited for daytime kind of drink. And let me not interrupt you again.
Okay,
by all means.
So this is amber. If we're going to talk color again, this matches the books really well. So people can't see, but the cover of the book is actually like an old Brooklyn brownstone with the brownstone on the bottom and brick on top, and it looks really nice. In fact, I think I'm going to take a picture of it.
Yeah, I think you should.
I'm going to definitely take a picture of it. So, which I'll do later. I don't need to do that now. But
let's remind each other.
We will remind each other.
Sure, on social media.
I actually really, even though I'm not a beer drinker, I have always really liked cider, because when I was in law school, I visited a friend in England, and mm-hmm. we went to a pub there, and that was the first time I had it.
Okay.
And I didn't know that it existed, and I thought it was the greatest thing ever.
Yep.
Because I like things that are sweet. I have a sweet tooth.
Yeah. Now, you know, I've got a weird relationship with it where I love beer, and thus the show, but I never think to drink cider. And every time I have it, I'm like, wow, this is really good. And my wife likes snake bites, you know, beer plus cider, and I would take a sip of it and always liked it. And just when it's go time at the taps and I'm deciding, I never ever think cider. And then every time I have it, I'm like, I should have cider more often. So
now you have to have more.
Let us.
Okay, we'll toast.
Let us
this.
Cheers, and then we shall.
This is really yummy. It's good. It's a drier one.
It's definitely
a drier one.
Yeah, yeah, which I like. And, you know, not drinking a lot of cider, I think it's a nice way to kind of ease into the world of ciders. That is very tasty. I'm going to read the tasting notes.
Okay.
From the Maalock website here. That sounds a lot like Maalocks, which I'm
which
hoping
is a bad.
I'm mispronouncing.
Yeah, we're not gonna.
Maybe it's Maalock.
We're gonna call it Maalock. Let's call it Maalock. Let's call it Maalock.
A proper host would have done this research here. Okay. Tasting notes. Color: orange ochre with salmon iridescence.
That is a very lovely. That was a writer who wrote that description.
That was a serious writer. Okay. The bouquet is balanced with tannic notes specific to the variety. And the taste, smooth and bitter, reminiscent of the astringency of beer. Okay. Those go a little over the top. But it tastes
good. But it's good. Yeah. I mean, bitter. It doesn't taste bitter to me. Does it taste bitter to you?
I don't taste bitter. No.
Yeah.
No.
I don't taste bitter.
Sweet. You know, yeah. I'm so used to the beer world that anytime I have cider,
it's going to be very sweet.
Sweet
to
on
you.
The tongue. Yeah.
It's but it's I've had a lot, and this one isn't that sweet.
Right.
Actually, I had a really good pear cider once.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was super sweet. Much too sweet for you.
Okay.
I would venture to guess. Yeah. So you stay away from pear cider that pear cider, which I don't remember what it was called. But I think this one is good. I mean, it is. It's like a nice. This is one that my husband and I could drink together.
Right.
You know, like it's a good. You could get it in. It's a husband wife cider. It's a good
cider.
Couple
that's,
cider.
That's really clever marketing, actually. Is your husband a beer drinker?
He's not much of a drinker generally, but he will drink beer. You know, he likes it, but he's not like a huge drinker at all.
Okay.
He's kind of, he used to be a big soda person until, you know, like I said, Mike, I'm 47. Like the whole acid reflux thing started to get to him. We're the same age. So now he's like been, right now actually, he's not drinking anything but water for a little while. He's just trying to get to feel a little bit better.
Okay.
So, but he would like this. He would like this. He would like the beer that we tried also.
Yeah.
He definitely likes it, but he doesn't know as much about it as these guys here at the Oath.
Right. So. With the Oath, they always have at least one cider on tap to go with the 19 or so beers. I'll share a couple more of the beers here. The Half Full Liquid Hoptimism IPA, that's out of Connecticut. Pipeworks Ninja versus Unicorn, a pretty insane double IPA that I did get to sample before we started here. That's out of Chicago, delicious beer. Jolly Pumpkin Madrugada Obscura Dark Dawn out of Michigan, and I'll give you one more here. Up in Connecticut, the Two Roads Kentucky Lightning. That is a moonshine-inspired bourbon-like ale. And I'm going to take a minute here, and I'm just going to do a little books and beer news.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so my day job, I got to speak with the New Rochelle author Jonathan Tropper the other day. He wrote This Is Where I Leave You, a bunch of other clever novels. And he says he's a year or two late on his next novel. And he's got a good reason. His television work is booming. Tropper is the co-creator of the Cinemax series Banshee. Banshee is a pretty rough and tumble story of a guy who kind of skirts the law while trying to enforce it. And Tropper's also at work on a drama inspired by an idea from Bruce Lee. It's set in San Francisco's Chinatown in the 1870s. It's called Warrior. And despite his booming TV work, Tropper told me, I still consider my day job to be a novelist. And then on the beer front, I spent Easter with the family near Rehoboth, Delaware. Rehoboth, of course, being Dogfish Head Brewing Country. And Dogfish has opened a restaurant next to its beloved brew pub in Rehoboth. And the restaurant was a fairly run-of-the-mill Irish pub called Finn Bar. And it would fill up primarily because there was a long wait all the time next door at Dogfish. So Dogfish ended up grabbing the space and making it its own. The new place is called Chesapeake and Maine, reflecting its local Delmarva roots. You ever heard the term Delmarva before?
I have not.
Delaware, Maryland, Virginia. You heard a lot when you're down that way.
I've heard Del Mar, but not Delmarva.
Yep, no, Delmarva. The founder of Dogfish, Sam Calajone, he had family roots in Maine where he used to spend summers at a place called Dogfish Head, Maine. So the restaurant's got a lot of seafood and a great beer selection. I did a sampler. I had the Namaste wheat beer. I had the Romantic Chemistry IPA. The Immort Ale, which was a peat-smoked ale brewed with maple syrup, and I had the Palo Santo Marone, a monster 12% alcohol brown ale aged in 10,000 gallon tanks made of Paraguayan Palo Santo wood, which is apparently the thickest, heaviest, densest wood you can find. Comes from the rainforest.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really
good
beer.
That's some serious beer storage.
The one challenge for the sampler, they've got a lot of their big, strong beers, and I was driving home. So I did have to add in a couple of the lighter beers to make sure I was keeping my head. But anyway, back to you, back to your work here. Anything you could tell us about? I think you referenced a second book in the works.
Before. Yeah. So I'm working on another book, which is another kind of family story.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually inspired, the main character is kind of inspired by my grandmother. Although it's, again, it's totally fiction, but you know, kind of your whole, you know, your life history creeps into the inspiration for works as a writer. So it's about an older woman and her granddaughter, and the granddaughter is about to marry the wrong guy, a guy that the grandmother actually dislikes so much that she can't even say his name. She refers to him only as the fiancé because she doesn't, she won't even, capitalize.
Okay.
She won't even say his name. And so she, in sort of watching her granddaughter in her march toward the aisle, she's reminded of her own marriage. And it's been fun to write because it flashes back also to, back to, you know, the 40s. Back to her, this woman, as a young woman, as a young bride, and, you know, the kind of very not good relationship that she had with her own husband and some secrets that she's been keeping for a very long time that come to light by the time the book, you know, comes to an end. So that's the story that's coming up.
Great. Now, so, is that with St. Martin's, or is that a free agent?
That is nobody yet, because, the people at St. Martin's have asked me, you know, what I'm working on next, but I'm not quite ready to share it yet. It's interesting, like, you can sell a book with just an idea for a book, or some people get two book deals or whatever it is. I don't know if I'm so comfortable with that, because I feel like, how do you really know? You know, books change a lot as you work on them. My books definitely did, and it goes in different directions, and, you know, I know what direction this is going to go in. I have a synopsis, but I'm not really ready yet for other eyes to be on it.
I gotcha.
So when I'm ready, you know, my agent has seen what I have, but I'm not really ready to show anybody else yet.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
What are you reading now? Anything good?
I just read... It's a total departure. I just read the greatest book. It's called Jane Steele. It's kind of by Lindsay Fay. It's a retelling of the Jane Eyre story, but it's, you know, the classic line, like in Jane Eyre when she marries the man is, "Reader, I married him." And the tagline for this book is, "Reader, I murdered him." So it's a very dark, but very clever, humorous twist.
Yeah.
And it's really fun. If you like, I love Sherlock, you know that show on the BBC?
Sure.
I love that show.
Yep.
If you are, like that kind of thing, and you're kind of a Sherlockian and you like that sort of genre, you'll really like that book. So, and then I just finished that, but I just actually read another great, a book that isn't out yet, called The Assistants by Camille Perry.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the books editor for Cosmo and also another magazine, maybe Esquire, I think, before that. So she's written a book that's a really fun story about an assistant to like a very wealthy tycoon type guy.
Huh.
And what happens when they sort of, she and some other assistants get together to kind of, not rob or steal from them exactly, but, you know, like maybe doctor some expense reports because there's so much money on one side and so many student loans on the other. So that's a really fun read. And then there's actually a book that is my next book. I have to get to this book, because I know it's great. It's called Georgia. It's about Georgia O'Keeffe by Dawn Tripp.
Okay.
Which has gotten really great reviews. And she lives in Massachusetts. She was actually my classmate in college. And so I'm really excited to read that book. So that's my next read.
We'll keep you busy while
the spring. Exactly. There are a lot of good, you know, the spring, there are a lot of good reads coming out now.
Sure.
So.
Sure.
Yeah.
And in terms of reading and writing, do you have a place in Westchester where you'd like to go and be alone?
That would be my kitchen. Okay. That's why I keep getting phone calls in my kitchen. I do really love the Chappaqua Library. I mean, the people there are great. I did my launch event the day that my book came out. I did a reading there.
Okay.
And we had like 130 people, and they were terrific. That was great. And there are, you know, there are a lot of nice, quiet spots to sort of sit and write there.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I write a lot at odd times, you know, I'll write very late at night, so I'm naturally, I'm at home, I can't like force them to open up the library for me at midnight. I don't think so. I don't think they're ever doing that.
James Patterson
You think he does? You think he opens up his town library at midnight? I don't know, I don't even think, I don't know.
He could if he wanted.
So a lot at home.
Okay, good. Well, I think we're done here, but I really appreciate you taking the time.
It was so fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to come to this place and try these awesome drinks and everything.
Good. Well, really appreciate you being part of the very first installment of the Oath-Based
podcast. I am very honored. It's excellent.
Books and Beer. Well, best of luck with your writing.
Thank you.
Do stay in touch. And we are signing off here. We've got Linda Cohen-Leugman, the author of The Two Family House. I am your host, Michael Malone. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.